Well, today, we're going to take another step forward in our practice, which everyone is really jazzed about, I know. And we know that as we deal with our past, it's important to identify the sin, like John Mark talked about last week. But it's also important to identify how that sin has impacted us day to day. We know, as relational beings, that even from the beginning of time, when we even look at the garden, that each one of us have been shaped significantly by the experience we've had with other humans, right? That through relationship, our greatest injury, our greatest trauma, our greatest pain, and even our greatest blessing has come by way of how we've interacted with other people. Or another way to put this, as my counselor so brilliantly puts it, is that our deepest wounds and our greatest healing comes from and through relationships with others. Ugh. What's also true is that this has not only impacted us, right? That the sins that we experience and have committed against us and have committed have impacted how we interact with relationships, but we also know, because we all did our genogram last week, that it's impacted our parents and our grandparents too. And then we also know from that the way that our parents were impacted and our grandparents were impacted kind of circles back and impacts us. That we inherited some kind of framework or pattern for how we view ourselves in relationships, for how we exist in relationships for one another, which is why it's so important to know where you come from. And most of us, whether knowingly or unknowingly, whether it's conscious or subconscious, can't deny that these patterns we've inherited from our sweet parents and grandparents have had some kind of power over us. If you've ever found yourself wondering why it is that you date the same kind of guy or girl over and over again, then you've experienced the impact of relational patterns. Or maybe it's when you get into a relationship with somebody that you kind of become one, and not in like the right way, in like a weird Plato kind of way, right? Where it's like, I don't know where I start and he ends, and there's this kind of weird enmeshment in relationship, and that's what happens to you every time you get into a relationship, and you can't figure out why that always happens. Or perhaps there's codependency every time you're in a relationship. You have to have it. Either you're codependent or they're codependent on you, but it's just in every relationship that you have, and there's this pattern. Or maybe it's too much to consider it's so personally, you know, like that you're the crazy one. So it's easier to look at the 30,000 feet level and observe that in your family, whether you've done your genogram or not, that there's a pattern that Uncle John and Aunt Jane got a divorce. Or that your mom and your dad got a divorce, and that your grandparents got a divorce, and there's this pattern of divorce in your family. And if you were honest with yourself, there's a fear in you that you'll repeat that pattern at some level. All of us have been impacted by the patterns of relationship we have had all around us. All of us have been informed in a big way about that. And I just want to say this. Nothing changes until something changes. Do you get what I'm saying? That the way we relate, the way we understand how we relate does not change unless we do something. Now, we are definitely going to dig into this, so buckle your seatbelts. But before we do, I'd like to pick up in the scriptures where we left off last week with a guy by the name of Joseph. Do you remember him? Some of you do. He was the son of Jacob. Do you remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Remember that? That the three big guys? Yeah, you remember them. And so Jacob's son was this guy named Joseph. You remember that? And last week, John Mark talked about how in Joseph's family, there was sin kind of committed over and over and over again. Going three generations back, we found that there was favoritism, lying, misogyny, awesome, and sibling rivalry, just to name a few. And I mean, what a blessed tribe they were. And what's crazy is these patterns, these men were all remarkable, but these patterns seem to rule this family. That is until we meet this guy named Joseph. And the question we're left with is how? How did Joseph break these patterns? How come this didn't show up in his life? And so tonight we're going to look at that. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 41. And as you do that, I'd like to give you a little summary of what happened before we got to 41. Sound good? So we're first introduced to Joseph in Genesis chapter 37. And we're introduced to him. What we know about him is that he was his father's favorite. Coincidence? I think not. He had a lot of brothers, and he was the least favorite, largely because he had a dream at a young age of all his brothers bowing to him. And then he, with gusto, shared that with them, which is problematic in so many ways. Bless his little punky heart. And so this is Joseph's experience. He did lots of things, but he made his brothers angry a lot of the times. And so ultimately, at some point, he made his brothers angry enough where they decided they would kill him. And you thought you had a weird relationship with your bro, you know what I mean? That's weird. And instead of killing him, they threw him into something called a cistern, which is really terrible and weird. And then they decided that wasn't the best idea, so we're going to sell him into slavery. We'll make a little profit. And so they told their dad, remember, they lied to their dad and said he was eaten by an animal, basically. And yet he was sold to slavery. And so from slavery, Joseph finds himself in prison. Talk about low to low. It's like low, lower. Things aren't looking up. So he goes to prison, and yet he has favor when he's in prison. And from prison, he somehow makes his way in front of Pharaoh and interprets a dream for Pharaoh. And Pharaoh makes him then the second highest ranking official in all of Egypt. So from slavery to second highest ranking official, which is pretty extraordinary. And might I add, by the age of 30. Mm-hmm. That should be convicting for some of us. Okay, let's read. I thought that was funny. Let's read. Let's read Genesis chapter 41. We're going to read verse 45, and then we're going to read verses 50 to 52. Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zephenath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Verse 50. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." Now this text, at first glance, does not feel that significant or show-stopping, but it is. Here we read in verse 45 that Joseph was given a wife. And some of us single people are thinking, if only it was that easy. Not a wife, I would prefer a husband, but... So he was given a wife, and then we read that he has two kids. And what's significant about this? Well, first, it's that Joseph had one wife. And that's significant because when you look back at his great-granddaddy Abraham, he had multiple wives. And then when you look at his grandfather, Isaac, you read that he also had multiple wives. And then you look at his dad, Jacob, and you read he had multiple wives. And for some reason, when we look at the life of Joseph, we see that he made a different choice. What we know about Joseph from the text earlier on is that he was extraordinarily handsome. What we also know is that he was a man of power. And those two things, sisters, are often a blessing, right? No reason you wouldn't want to partake or join in, at least have a conversation. Joseph could have had multiple wives. But we see that he chose and made a deliberate choice to do something different. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why did he do that? In verse 50 to 52, we read that he had two sons. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Abraham had two sons that are very significant in this story. Remember Ishmael and Isaac. And then you look at Jacob, or you look at Isaac, and he had two sons, Jacob and Esau. And now, here we are, Jacob has a lot of sons, and now Joseph has two. And what's significant here is that each son that Joseph had, he blessed. Now, the big rivalry thing happened with the brothers early on in the family of origin. Like with Abraham, it was pretty controversial. He chose Isaac largely because Sarah was like team Isaac, and then that happened again with Isaac. It just this complicated, it just kept happening. We see here, you know, it seems really small, but it's highly significant that Joseph blessed both of his sons. Well, how do we know that he blessed them? Well, in the Hebrew culture, it was really significant when a father gave a son a name that had meaning. And here in the text, we all read a million years later, not literally, but we read a million years later that Joseph gave and blessed both of his sons with these names that were specific. Not one pegged against the other, not one over the other, but both of them given honor by their father. Again, another deliberate choice that we see Joseph making. Now, life goes on for Joseph and his family, and they continue to do Egypt things, you know? And then we find in chapter 42 that Joseph's brothers come back on the scene. So I'd like for us to read just a second. We're going to read chapter 42, verses 1 to 6 together, and then we'll talk about it. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob is Joseph's father, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" That is such a dad thing to say, you know? What are you just looking at each other for? Go do something. He continued, "I have heard that there's some grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." Then ten of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to them. Him. That's a little bit weird. Anyway, I mean, I'd feel weird about it. I'd be like, well, how come he's... Anyway, there's just something to think about. It's another teaching. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was a famine in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold the grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Now here in chapter 42, we find that Jacob sends his boys down to Egypt to get some food because they were starving. Part of what Joseph interpreted for Pharaoh early on in his dream was that there'd be a famine that lasted 7 years in the land. And Joseph's primary job was to steward the land in such a way that they could provide for all the people in the area and that they would become this big conglomerate, which is kind of what happened. And so here we find Joseph's brothers coming to Egypt and unknowingly bowing down before their brother. And the text makes it clear that Joseph knew it was them, but they didn't know it was him. And here they were, just as the dream predicted, that they were bowing down before their brothers. And I don't want you to miss this. Joseph could have killed them right then and there. He had all the power, all the right, and all the authority to do it. He could have imprisoned them as a mercy, or he could have sold them in slavery as another mercy. And he could have continued to wreak havoc in this sibling rivalry kind of continuum that their family was on. And yet he chose to do something very different than I would argue most of us would ever do. Here, Joseph, after a little bit of, he kind of messes with them a tiny bit, but he eventually gives them the grain that they're asking for. And once again, we see Joseph choosing to do something different. To bless instead of curse, to love instead of hate, to give instead of withholding. And he continues to be a great surprise to us as we read about him. Okay, turn with me one more time. Genesis chapter 45. We're going to read verses 1 to 7. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there's been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So the brothers went home after they got the first grain dealio, and they had to come back again because they were still hungry. So they circled back, and once again, Joseph found them before him on the ground. And the text tells us that he was overcome with emotion. And I've tried to wrap my head around probably what he was sensing. And honestly, I kind of lose my mind when I'm trying to do it. Because I don't know, if when they left the first time, he was thinking, I wonder if they'll be back. Wonder if I'll get an opportunity, I don't know. Or what it was. But all we know is that he was overcome with emotion. And it wasn't the kind that you're imagining. The emotion we read about in this text is pure. It's extraordinarily loving. He almost sounds excited. You know what I mean? It's like this is the opposite of what we'd expect him to feel. And then we look at the brothers, and I cannot imagine what they must have been thinking. Oh my gosh, I would have been scooting my backside up out that door so quick. I mean, fast as I could if I were one of them. Do you know what I'm saying? Because surely they thought, he's going to kill us. This is it. He knows who we are. And not only that, but he's known who we are. And I wonder if they even had enough time to think, oh my gosh, this is what the dream was. And the fear that must have grown in them as they were thinking through the implications of what they had done. And this man who had every right to be bitter, every right to resent them and to retaliate in this moment, doesn't. Instead, we read that it wasn't even on his radar. What was that God had used his circumstances to bless them. Not him, like, hey guys, thank you for that, because now I'm awesome and rich. And also I'm handsome. But God had used our circumstances to bless us. It's like if someone won the lottery in your family and they were like, oh my gosh, we're millionaires. And you're thinking, yes, we are. Right? It's like this moment where it's like they shouldn't have shared in it, and yet Joseph's perspective was them. It's not me and them. It's us. It's a we narrative we find in here. And his perspective is unfathomable to me, because I think it's like the one time really thick and easy for me to access in the text that this is just the most palatable, gracious, forgiving love I have encountered or even tried to understand apart from the love and forgiveness I experienced at the foot of Jesus' cross. Like, it's that similar. And in this love and with this love and forgiveness, we see that Joseph just cut off the generational brokenness. That everything that once was in that moment became undone because of the love and compassion and grace that he showed his brothers. From the life of Joseph, we see a lot of things, but there are three things I think we see from him. The first is that Joseph lets his family inform him. What do I mean by that? And I mean his family of origin. I mean those who went before him and where he is now. Joseph looked at his family, and at some level, I don't know how he did it, whether it was through a genogram or not, highly doubt it, but maybe. I mean, these were the Egyptians we're talking about. I have no idea. But here he was, and there was something about the narrative that his family had in years past that he did not like. I mean, you got to remember, he was like a person who grew up in a home much like you grew up in a home, who had parents much like you have parents, right? So he knew about Pawpaw, Abraham. You know, he had dinner with Pawpaw. I don't know what they call him. In the South, that's what we call him, you know? He knew who his uncle Esau was. None of these people are mysterious to him, yet he knew about their great legacy, and he also knew about their great dysfunction. And he made a decision based on what he knew to choose something different. There's an extraordinary wisdom when we do that, when we let our family of origin inform us about who we are, but also about what we want to become. And that's what's mysterious here, too, is that we see that Joseph allowed his past not only to inform him, but to change him. He made deliberate choices. He could have chosen like 16 wives, and he chose one. And he chose to bless his sons instead of picking one over the other. We see that he was a man of integrity. We see that he chose the right things. And in the moment where he had every right, according to every earthly standard, to curse and to kill his offenders, he chose something extraordinarily different. He was changed. And I imagine it had a lot to do with what happened in that cistern, what happened in that prison cell, what happened when the Lord was with him in all of those places. But he was changed. The other thing that I think is just the best thing about Joseph is that he let his past or his family, what had happened in the past, bless him. And not only bless him, but he let it bless others. Do you remember what the next story is in the scripture after Joseph? It's the people of Israel. Do you know what the people of Israel are? Those are people who were going to, through their line, bring Messiah to the universe. And we would be sitting here today because of that great faithfulness. The choices that Joseph made were catalytic in your life and in mine. Now, I'm not saying it all depended on this one moment, but I am saying it had an extraordinary impact on how the generations after him would function and flourish. And that's a powerful, powerful narrative. So, three things for you today. The first is that I think the past must inform us. We have to let it do that. Even if we're scared, even if we're overwhelmed. And when we look at our past, we have to start, unfortunately, for a lot of us at the very beginning. Studies show us that very early on, they say as early as, some studies say, as early as the day you're born, you begin to build out your understanding of how to work and function in relationships. Other people with other studies actually believe that's happening in utero. That's happening in the womb, that you're actually learning how to relate to other people when you're in your mother's stomach. That you're being informed in some way that's going to shape you and your future relationships. That's extraordinary. And for most of us, that means we have had now decades of information about how we are to function and be in relationship. There was a study done in the 1970s by this woman named Mary Ainsworth. All you Psych 101 students are like, I just took a test on that. Right? And this is a study about, the formal word here is attachment. And Mary took about like 100 middle-class families, and they put parents and young kids together. And over time, they observed their interactions. And then over another period of time, they'd introduce strangers into that setting and see how the child related, and they'd observe, and then so on and so forth. From the study, Mary concluded that there are four primary ways as humans that we connect or attach to one another. Now, just like to up front let you know, I'm not a PhD, despite what appearances seem. And so I'm just going to brush over these things. The point of us sharing this is that you would ask Jesus about it. Ask maybe where you fit, and hopefully this will be helpful for you. So there's kind of two umbrellas of attachment. There's one called secure attachment over here. And then there's another one called insecure attachment. This is where most of us keep our zip code, including your friend up here. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what these are. So secure attachment is when someone at their base level is emotionally secure with who they are. That they're happy, there's a freedom to explore in relationships, like intimately wise, like they're going like, oh, I'm not afraid to go to deep places or to connect with you. In fact, I feel pretty safe doing that. That would be a term. And so in the experiment with Mary, in this setting, like a mother would leave her child in the room and the child would cry, which is pretty normal, like, I want my mom. And when the mother came back, the mother would pick up the child and console the child. And pretty quickly, the child would calm down. And the child was playing with its mom beforehand, and so after the mom would console it, they would go back to doing what they were doing. They had learned at some formative level that when I have needs, my mom's going to come and take care of them. She's going to meet the needs that I have. And that formed in that person a very secure attachment with other people. Now, like I mentioned, most of us are living in the other camp. Bless us. Under the umbrella of insecure attachment. There's an attachment style called anxious attachment, which is also sometimes called an ambivalent attachment. And this is where someone generally feels emotionally anxious or insecure in relationship. Sometimes this manifests as anger, tension, who knows what it may be, but at the formative level of who this person is, they generally believe that they can't rely on others to get their needs met. Now, if you're wondering, Bethany, I can't imagine where you'd be on this spectrum, you just hit the jackpot. I am an anxious attachment person, although God's healing me and helping with me with that. Early on in my life, there was a threat to my attachment, and I actually did believe that people weren't safe, and that I needed to either pursue or please them in order to have an actual attachment with them. That's kind of how that's informed me. And in Mary's study, this is what would happen. The mom would come in after the kid was crying, pick the kid up, console the child, and then after a few minutes, the child had calmed down, the child would sometimes take a swing at their mom. Look, y'all need to work in the nursery if you're confused about what that is, because that's like a real thing, right? There's like anger, right? The child would respond or overly emotionally respond to the parent and was unconsolable. So this is kind of what would happen. The child learned at some level that their needs would not always be met, that mom would not always come and take care of them. And so they learned that not everybody's safe, that they have to work for it in order to be connected. The next is something called an avoidant attachment. And this, someone basically believes at a formative level that they need to remain emotionally distant. They're generally reluctant to explore intimacy with other people. And they carry a subconscious belief that their needs will probably not be met, period. And so in Mary's study, child would come, would be crying, mother would come in, console the child, and then the child, after being consoled, would literally posture its body away from its mother as an act of, like, fear that if I'm intimate with you, this is going to keep getting broken, and that would break our attachment. And so this is kind of how that played out. Now, fourth, there's one called disorganized attachment, and this one, it kind of combines the two of anxious and avoidant. This is when somebody is generally emotionally depressed or angry or non-responsive. They're generally confused about how to get their needs met. They're not really sure, so they try out both of these. Sometimes it comes out as an anxious attachment, and sometimes it comes out as an avoidant attachment. And again, what we observed in Mary's study is that the child would either avoid the parent after being consoled, or they would anxiously try to pursue or be aggressive towards their parent. Now, here's what I want you to get from all that. You should go talk to a therapist, but I don't know. I'm just trying to throw some stuff out there. I mean, it is helpful, but honestly, what we know at the core of attachment is this, that every single person, every single tiny human to grown-up adult in this room has an innate need to be pursued, has an innate need to be enjoyed, and has an innate need to be intimately known. And from a tiny, tiny age, we are inputting information that reflects that. We're trying to figure out if we're pursuable, or if we're enjoyable, or if anyone would actually want to know us. And the problem is sin entered the picture and messed everything up. So many of us are walking around with some false beliefs about who we are in relationship. That you're not pursuable, or that you're not enjoyable, or that nobody wants to intimately know you, and that's just not true. Richard Plass and James Cofield, the authors of The Relational Soul, summed it up perfectly when they said, "The quality and character of the programming we received early in life establishes a pattern of attachment that controls our relationships later in life." Figuring out how you relate to people is super, super significant, because it's not just people that you were designed to relate to. How you relate to other people, 9 out of 10 times, is how you actually relate to God. In fact, I'm going to go 10 out of 10 on that one. No, you don't understand. My parents were this, or they didn't do this, and so it's not the same. God and I have this really deep, intimate connection, and I would just push back on that and say that there's a good chance that if you have a really dysfunctional, messed up relationship with your parents, and listen, I've been there, we've all been there, but if you're not working towards it, working towards healing and life and functionality in it, then there's a really severe danger in saying that you're totally fine in your relationship with God, because God calls you to wholeness. Your entire person is being called to reconciliation, and those you come in contact with are called to the same thing. I don't want you to miss the significance of understanding how you relate, because I know that how you relate is how you relate. Are you with me? How you relate to other people in relationship is how you relate to God. How you connect or attach with other people is how you relate to God. Now, I know we live in a totally broken world. Trust me when I say I know. And that a lot of you are going like, I don't know, I'm all the insecure attachments. I know, that's how I come up on the bus too. I'm like, I think I'm just everything, I'm not sure. But here's what I want to say about that. This is where Jesus perfectly fits in. Are you with me? Because Jesus has always and will always want to pursue you. Amen. Jesus has and will always enjoy you. And Jesus has and always will want to intimately know you. And guess what he does? Jesus is the perfect attachment, which means no matter what my list says, where I most identify, that I'm anxious attachment, it means that I can find healing and healthy attachment through and by Jesus. That's what that means. He is the one who wants to reconcile all things. So how do we let the past inform us? We take inventory of these things. We figure out how we relate. And the next question we ask is, how do we let our past change us? Now, in order to get a grip on how we relate, the thing we have to do is be honest with ourselves, which is kind of terrible sometimes. And so for me, this kind of plays out. I just want to share with you my genogram, which is just a wonderful blessing. You're welcome to pick any name you want for any of your kids. We're totally open. There's an Inez and a Clyde, so you know, there's some options. But it's so important for us to know what's happened in our history so that we know where to start. Many of you are like, where do we start with this? Well, what are the relational patterns presently? You know there's some lingering deep down in here, but right now they're not up here yet. So where do we start? We look at our genogram. So it's not marked out because of discretion and wanting to honor my family. But what you can't see, and what I'm going to point out to you, is that on my mother's side, my mom is Belinda, that on my mother's side, from Inez to Margaret Rose to Belinda, is a strong line of matriarchy. That basically just means a strong line of strong women. And not like the hoorah kind of strong women. I mean, they are wonderful. But these women largely operated out of an insecurity and false pride about who they were. There was a narrative that they were filling in the gaps for people who didn't show up and that they were going to be fine all by themselves. And that's kind of my line. So that's one thing. The other thing you can tell from my mom's side is that there's a series of divorce. That's a pretty clear pattern that I can acknowledge that I don't want to participate in. If you look at my dad's side, the blessing is none of these people actually know Jesus, except for my dad. And there is four generations of marital faithfulness. I mean, who could have called that? That's just crazy. And so there's alcoholism on both sides of my family. And there's a pattern of abandonment as well in my family. And I say all this just to point it out and say to you that it's really important that we know what's happening here so we know what we don't want to do. I remember the first time I did my genogram, and I was so proud of myself. I was thinking, man, these people are crazy, and you are awesome. You're doing great. You're doing great, and thank God they have you on this last tier. You're really going to change the game, right? That's called pride. It needs to be cracked off of somebody. Now, God quickly did that as I sat there and realized that the patterns I was so frustrated by on this genogram were the very things I was already living into. That's the scary moment, because some of you are avoiding doing this because you know it's already happening. That those things from the past are already having power over you. And my call to you tonight, and just maybe my statement to you would be, God's not calling you back there to shame you or to condemn you, but to free you. Amen. He calls us to look back and to be mindful, like, hey, this is a bad, these are things I don't want to repeat, and then to ask, how am I going to change them? At some point, Joseph had to confront the reality of misogyny in his family and go, that seems like a bad idea. I don't want to do that anymore. And he did. Patterns give us insight, not only to where we come from or how we've been impacted, but also to what we're already living into. And you can't allow that to scare you. A lot of us dismiss ourselves from this genogram, like, I'm not divorced, so it's no big deal. I've not abandoned anybody, so it's no big deal. I'm not like them. And that's what I told myself until I realized that I actually had abandoned most of my friends emotionally because I was terrified that at some point they would leave me. I was no different than anyone who left anyone in my family tree because I had done everything I needed to do. I overcompensated in relationship in the hopes that they wouldn't leave me. And yet I ended up with shallow, empty relationships of abandonment. It's so easy for us to dismiss that you're not an alcoholic. And I get that there's so much intertwined with substance abuse, so hear me when I say this. Many of you may not be an alcoholic, but you may be a workaholic. There are things we need to confront in here in order to be free. The purpose of doing this is that we can be changed by it. Now, here's the beautiful thing. You can't change it all by yourself, which is awesome. That's good news for most of us because most of you are not good at that. You've tried it, actually. Do you know what I'm talking about? How you've tried not to do that thing? The thing we have to do is get to a point of humility. And I'm not talking like, you know, sackcloth and ashes. I mean, maybe some of you, I don't know. But we have to get to a place where we're willing to ask for help. Help and humility go hand in hand. Some of you need to start with asking God for help. You've been avoiding this conversation for far too long, and God is calling you tonight to talk to him about it, to tell him what you're afraid of, to allow him into the conversation. Most of you have done your genogram without inviting him in for 1 second. And I get that. That's what I do. I'm like, you are so sweet. You go sit over there. I'm going to work on this. You have so many other things. I mean, that's how I'm doing. Honestly, it sounds so silly, but it's true. Tonight, the call is to ask God for help, for him to show you what it means to be healed, to give you an idea of what it would look like if your genogram really did change at this point. What it would look like for your kids if those patterns actually stopped. And whether you're 18 or 42, the kids are coming. There are people who would be impacted by your relational patterns, by the sins we carry on. And so the time is ticking. Some of you need to ask for help in community. Some of you need to get your backsides into community. And I love you, but listen, we don't learn how to relate again unless we are life on life with other people, living it out, breathing it out day to day in relationship with others. With people who are going to say to you when you freak out and have a bad day, I'm not going anywhere. I want you to learn what it means when Jesus says, I'll never leave you or forsake you, and I'm going to physically be a presence of that in your life. That's what community means. Some of you need to ask your community for help. It's time to start sharing with them what's really going on. What scares you about this, and let them be with you on the journey. Finally, some of you need to go see a counselor, and I just love you. And I'm not speaking to you from a pious place. I'm speaking to you of 8 years of solid therapy, and I am just, I mean, look at me now. Right? There are times and moments in our life where we need to say, I need a little bit more help. There's no shame or condemnation in therapy. I think it's awesome. Someone asked me this morning, aren't you mad that you had to go to so much therapy? I thought my response would be like, yes. But my response was, no, what a privilege. And I meant that. It's a privilege that God set me free. Then I'm not going to my grave in bondage, but I am living a life currently in freedom. Sometimes we have to go to those deeper places to find the freedom God is calling us to. Now, I'm going to wrap us up real quick. In Genesis chapter 50, and if we had time, we'd read it. But in Genesis chapter 50, verses 15 to 21, we kind of get the final narrative. Joseph's brothers, Jacob died, so their dad died, and they started to freak out. You know, like things were good while dad was alive because he was the peacekeeper. But they started to freak out when Jacob died. So they sent a letter and they lied to him, which is just, you know, they need to work on their stuff a little bit more. But basically, the sum of it was Joseph's response, and here's what he said. Satan intended so many things for evil, but what he has intended for evil in our family, God has meant for good. I don't want you to miss this. You have to let your past bless you. And what I mean by that is God's given you a story, and not only you, but he's given your family a story. And what he wants to do, he wants to take all that that junk, and he wants to bring life and revival and resurrection power to it. All that stuff that you think is impossible, he wants to show up and do it. And then he wants you to tell people about it. Like I said, I've been in therapy for a very long time, which is why I am the way I am, for better and worse. And the reason I went to therapy, honestly, was because I was in a relationship where I was absolutely stuck. I couldn't figure out why this person didn't love me the way I wanted them to love me, and I kept repeating the same cycle for, like, years. And I'm, like, fairly smart. But I just couldn't figure it out. I just couldn't figure out what was going on, why I was repeating the same things, and the pain of being stuck superseded the pain of addressing my stuff. I mean, that's where I was at. I was like, I can't live like this anymore. And I remember the first time my counselor said, you need to do your genogram, and I thought, okay, no problem. Look at this. I mean, I got a good map, you know what I mean? And I remember it was so difficult once I got into it. And the only way I can describe it to you is that I felt as I was filling in all these patterns, relational patterns of dysfunction in my own life and in the lives of others, was that it was like a confessional, a beautiful confessional to God. Whereas I wrote every name and every sin, every offense, all the things I could muster up, it was like I was saying to God, I don't want it to be this way anymore. I don't want to repeat what has been done. I don't want my kids to feel what I have felt. I do not want them to know what I have known. And I would do anything, anything to make it different for them. And you know what he said? Okay. And that began just some incredibly hard work that I had to do. But what I realized specifically as I was writing this teaching was that that moment wasn't just for me. What I couldn't have realized in that moment when I was doing this weird genogram exercise was that it would be for you too. We asked you to do this not because we're trying to get you into some checklist thing or we're trying to fill up every therapist's office we know. We're doing it because we're living, breathing testimonies of how it changed our lives. I'm here to tell you that God has been extraordinarily and miraculously faithful to me and to my family. And when I was thinking specifically about this sin of matriarchy that has wrecked my family that I was stepping into right when I entered the therapist office, I realized God said to me, you know, you're a pastor of women. And I said, uh-huh. And he said, that's right. And he said, and you're not leading because some man didn't show up to fill a gap. And you're not leading because you're trying to prove a point or make a space for everybody and hoorah. I am leading because I am joyfully sure that God has made me unique as a woman in the kingdom of God. And I am leading from a place of freedom, not of matriarchy, but of submission to my king. This is what it means to be redeemed. These tangible expressions and miraculous moments of God's presence and his healing power in your life. And many of you have been doing the genogram and you just think there's no way. And I'm here to tell you tonight that God is able to do exceedingly and abundantly beyond what you can even ask or imagine. Would you pray with me? Would you stand and pray with me?